All right.
Be seated, please. The court is now ready to hear argument in the final cause of the morning. It's 090481, the Susan Combs, Comptroller of Public Accounts of the State of Texas, and Greg Abbott, Attorney General of the State of Texas, versus Texas Entertainment Association and CarPod, Inc.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, four decades of precedent support the state's power to impose even greater restrictions on adult businesses than the Texas law.
That's presuming this is interpreted to be a restriction rather than a tax. And has there been any Supreme Court case that has said a fee operates as a restriction and under the secondary effects analysis?
I think there are several things going on in Your Honor's question. I'll try to hit each of them. In terms of taxes and fines, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld regulations of adult businesses that are enforced strictly by fine. In Young, the zoning issue upheld in Young was enforced by a fine,
but
likewise.
But never by a tax, right? So we're on new ground here.
New grounds in the sense that the terminology has changed, but the substance really is not different. If I could maybe cut to the premise of Your Honor's question, if the Court were to conclude that there were two interests served by this law, on the one hand, revenue will be raised, but on the other hand, we have certainly asserted an additional interest, an interest in deterring this combustible combination of activities.
But isn't that
in order to prevent?
Isn't that the primary reason is to raise revenue? And it seems like that reason to raise revenue is really an umbrella to do this. In that, what is secondary is to fund that money to this these situations, which obviously money is needed, and it seems like it's more of a punishment.
Well, we only need one purpose. First of all, if it's punishment, that's like the other cases where the ban was, in fact, upheld. If there's only one purpose that the Court finds legitimate, the fee is valid, and that's the Pabst AM case, where in Pabst AM, frankly, it was a much more difficult case for the state in that sense, because in Pabst AM, there were two interests that the Court identified. One was to combat secondary effects, rape, sexual assault, other crimes. There was also evidence, substantial evidence, that the City Council simply didn't like pornography, didn't like new dancing, and the Court said one purpose is enough.
But does the activity, the new dancing, as it were, have to tie into the purpose that the state is trying to protect, which is to raise fees for victims of violence, domestic violence?
The state has to be concerned with secondary effects. The question, I think, for the Court is where can the court look to find that evidence that the government interest being served includes secondary effects? And we would submit that the Supreme Court has repeatedly said you can look anywhere. In fact, the Court has never said that you have to look just in the contemporaneous legislative history.
But typically, the analysis on secondary effects has been to entirely eliminate them. It's either been by an outright ban or by a zoning regulation so that it's completely outlawed. Here, you're not outlawing the activity. You're just putting a fee on it.
If I may use an analogy, Your Honor, and I think it will answer Your Honor's question. Imagine speeding laws. Right. If every jurisdiction in Texas were to amend its laws and to say every mile over the speed limit is now punished by $10,000 per mile, that would frankly have a much better deterrent effect. Right, many more deaths would be prevented, but there would be no revenue because presumably nobody would want to incur that fee. Now, to be fair,
if you put a First Amendment overlay on that, because that doesn't have First Amendment implications.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Is that is not a First Amendment case, but the principle is the same. Because the principle is there can be two purposes. There's absolutely nothing wrong or peculiar with a tax that has two effects, one to raise revenue, but another to have some sort of substantial deterrent effect. And there's certainly no dispute. It's undisputed in this case that this fee has a substantial deterrent effect. We're doing exactly what California did in the LaRue case. In LaRue, the U.S. Supreme Court took a look at what California was concerned about. You have the combination of alcohol, which causes people to be uninhibited. You combine that with exposure to not only live nude dancing, but pornography and other aspects. That combination, the court said, you can absolutely regulate. It would frankly be, if anything, turning the First Amendment on its head to say that you can criminalize, but you can't impose a sort of a more modest regulation.
Should the fee be $5? Wouldn't it be a greater deterrent if it was $10 or $15 or $20?
It may be, and that we would submit as a quintessential legislative policy call. All the time, the legislature will determine a certain crime should be punished by a felony or by a misdemeanor, a different level of penalty. And in this case, the U.S. Supreme Court has been emphatically clear, we want to especially encourage deference to the legislature to make different calls.
And in looking at secondary effects, what can any group then come up and say, you know, we are also affected by the toxic combination that you've described, and then also receive funding or look for an additional tax?
Well, I should be clear, how the money is spent isn't necessary to our defense of the statute. If the money were burned in the public square, still be valid. For example, in the cases that the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld, where there was a financial assessment, not jail time or at least jail was an option, but they had fine as an option, they never said, well, it depends on how the fine is spent. They've never said that because that's not the critical point, is the deterrence of this combination. It is undisputed in the record, both in the trial and in the briefing of this court, this fee will discourage, is substantially discouraging adult businesses from combining alcohol consumption with live nudity. That's exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court said we could do in numerous cases from California versus LaRue all the way up to 44 Liquor Mart. 44 Liquor Mart, in fact, the court was unanimous
under
in endorsing that.
Under that principle, could the state also want to discourage drinking and assess a cover charge for every establishment that serves liquor?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Belanca. In Belanca, the U.S. Supreme Court said that certainly governments can say, we're going to limit the sale of alcohol. And the U.S. Supreme Court further said, if you can do that, then certainly you can limit alcohol just in adult businesses. Both of those powers are well within state governmental.
One of the amici aligned with the state argues that this case is not really about nude dancing at all. It doesn't implicate the First Amendment at all. It's really about being able to drink while watching nude dancing. What do you make of that amici's argument?
I think that's a powerful argument. This law is just like California versus LaRue in the sense that if you want to continue on, don't have alcohol, or for that matter, engage in different forms of adult expression other than live nude dancing, which live nude dancing we know from Barnes and Pabst AM is actually not subject to absolute protection. In those cases, the government completely prohibited it, and the court upheld it in both cases.
So it can apply to films as well as live entertainment? Same theory being in place?
It would depend on what the fee says. If the regulation is no alcohol combined with any number of adult forms of entertainment, that would be just like LaRue. But if Your Honor is saying, what if you don't put aside the alcohol? What if it's just a total ban on all adult expression? Candidly, we think that would be a more difficult case. That is, interestingly, pretty much what the legislature thought about when they looked at an alternative proposal by Representative Thompson, a bill that I believe plaintiffs seem to believe is valid according to the legislative record. That law would have said a tax on door charges on all forms of adult entertainment. That's, we would submit, very different from this law and frankly harder to defend, because our law only circumscribes a very small category of adult entertainment, nudity and alcohol, whereas Thompson covers everything. We can ban what the Texas law currently targets. We can get rid of all adult entertainment that combines those two things. Under current precedent, we can't ban all adult entertainment altogether.
Well, I'm having a hard time with the distinction. Yeah, certainly live versus video is different, but I mean, it's still a sexually oriented business. And I'm not sure why one was singled out rather than the broad category.
The key point of distinction is the alcohol, right? Because our case is only applies to alcohol, LaRue covers it completely.
So the effect that you're trying to deter with the fee, that is to say, what it would be applied for, would not apply with respect to alcohol being served at, say, a picture theater showing pornographic films?
The current Texas law would not apply if it was not live nudity.
One amicus also argues that there's no expressive conduct at all at issue here. Do you think there's no free speech issue at all?
Under the Scalia and Thomas view, there would be no First Amendment issue whatsoever. Under the holdings of the court, there is only the most minimal protection, and that protection it does not apply here, because our interest is in combating secondary effects. Again, I think the fatal flaw of plaintiff's position is this. When we talk about the regulation of expressive conduct, that's the O'Brien framework and all the cases following that cite O'Brien, you have to distinguish between state interests that focus on the expression and state interests that focus on the conduct. The Thompson bill seems to focus on the expression by saying we're going to get rid of all of it. This bill, the current law, targets not all adult entertainment, not at all adult expression, but just when it combines alcohol with live nude dancing. Let me be very clear on this point. We can get rid of all the alcohol. That's LaRue and all of its progeny, including 44 Liquor Mart. We can also get rid of all live nudity. That's Pabst and Barnes.
But then the state, when they've been able to have this statute that raises $25 million for its intended purpose, Let me ask you this.
But it depends, because a lot of the laws that were upheld by the Supreme Court did generate funds through fines.
Well, but if there's no entertainment business, then there's no revenue to collect. Let me ask you this.
Well, it's like speeding. Speeding occurs even though it's technically illegal.
Okay. The TEA says that the state improperly uses post-enactment evidence to analyze this, and that on a constitutional basis that it's not narrowly tailored. Could you address that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. A majority of the court below essentially agreed that we have the power to do this. The issue below was really the evidentiary issue that Your Honor is asking, so let me address this straight on. I want to commend whoever scheduled the cases this morning, because I think this case provides a very nice contrast to the first case, from the first case that we heard this morning. Because in the first case, we have the U.S. Supreme Court repeatedly telling courts that there's a very high evidentiary burden when it comes to Congress wanting to abrogate state sovereign immunity. At the same time, for purposes of this case, the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly urged the opposite. They've urged a very low evidentiary standard when it comes to state and local governments wanting to regulate in this very sensitive area of alcohol and adult businesses. The court has said time and time again that it will uphold regulations of adult businesses so long as they can find a valid interest in secondary effects. They have to find a secondary effects interest. But they can find it anywhere. They can find it in the statutory text. They can find it in the legislative history. But they could also forget all of that and find it only in current governmental interest, only in legal briefs filed in the U.S. Supreme Court, in Barnes at page 2.
Let me just ask you this. How should we look at the fact that the regulation here is in the form of a tax? Should we look at that a little more strictly, that you're putting a tax on expressive conduct as opposed to a regulatory type scheme? And that seems to be counsel's argument, that this is first and foremost a tax on speech.
It is indeed counsel's argument. It was an argument that a majority below rejected, and I think rightly so for this reason. All the tax cases they cite involve activities that the state could not ban, whereas the traditional principle of the power to tax is the power to destroy has real purchase in those cases. That's not true here. We can ban this.
Can you distinguish Simon and Schuster? I was surprised that there wasn't much discussion of that case, and that seemed fairly similar scenario.
Well, Simon and Schuster involved talking about books like Malcolm X and the autobiography of MLK, things that we can't ban. There's no question that we cannot ban books.
Well, but my understanding of the statute in Simon and Schuster was books that were, and this particular book, graphically recounted crimes, and that's sort of reprehensible conduct, which some view this conduct as well. And so if that type of speech is protected, Then why shouldn't this be? Or the same analysis apply?
Well, because it's a very different kind of speech, Your Honor. That kind of speech in Simon & Schuster is entitled to full protection. The U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly warned courts not to equate traditional core First Amendment speech, artistic speech, political speech, not to equate that with adult speech. In LaRue, at page 118, the court was very emphatic not to confuse the two. And even Justice Brennan, who dissented in many of these cases, explained in Renton at 55 and 56 that these are two very different areas. Just because you're upholding adult regulation doesn't mean you would uphold artistic or other forms of regulation. I see my time is running out. If I may make one brief point, if there are no other questions. Plaintiff's argument is essentially premised on characterizing Texas as a content-based tax, notwithstanding decades of precedent regulating similar laws targeting precisely the same activities. We think this is especially curious because if anything might be a content-based tax, it might be the proposal by Representative Thompson, which plaintiffs say is valid. After all, Texas law applies only to adult businesses that combine alcohol with live nudity, a combustible combination of activities that Texas can ban. By contrast, the Thompson proposal applies to all adult businesses, which Texas cannot ban under current U.S. Supreme Court precedent. So it's difficult to reconcile their position here with 40 years of precedent, not to mention their position on Thompson. Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
It actually isn't for the court's help. It's for me to remember what my argument is. I'll follow the chart through. May it please the court, Stuart Whitehead is sitting at counsel with me and has been the main counsel in this case throughout. This is a tax case. There is no question about it. And the tax statute is targeted, uses as one of its identifiers for when the tax is imposed, protected speech. The state concedes that they cannot meet strict scrutiny, and they have not cited any case to this court. And we have cited several.
What about the Utah case?
Your Honor, the Utah case is its very opening statement said this is not a content-based tax, and in fact the tax was imposed on nudity. And the tax was not imposed on live nude performance. Our tax is imposed only in the presence of live nude performance. This is a content-based tax.
Do you disagree with the state that the lawmakers could, if they wanted to, just impose an outright ban on live nude entertainment?
I disagree that they could impose an outright ban on live nude entertainment. I'm not even sure if Justice Scalia could be convinced that there is a message with live nude entertainment, and it was that message that was targeted, that it would violate the First Amendment. He's just not convinced that there's a message worth protecting. But that does tell you that if it's the message that you're targeting, you cannot ban live nude entertainment. Let me briefly call the court's attention to the chart.
Counsel, before you go to the chart,
yes.
How do you reconcile Erie versus Pabst with your statement that the state cannot ban public nudity generally?
Your Honor,
and not just Justice Scalia's concurrence, but the majority judgment in that case.
Your Honor, I disagree. In Pabst, the whole question was whether they were banning nudity, which is and conduct, or not banning live nude entertainment. The discussion in Barnes and the discussion in Pabst was whether the banning of conduct, which had an incidental impact on speech, was prohibited. And they said it was content neutral, it had an incidental impact, and therefore the ordinance was permissible in those cases.
So
but I'm not sure it was a complete ban.
So your distinction is that this situation involves expression and regulation of content, and Erie versus Pabst did not involve those two things.
Erie and Pabst, the argument was made because it incidentally affected speech.
That's the distinction.
So you believe they could ban public nudity but not nude public entertainment?
That's correct, Your Honor, because the difference is between the conduct that's being banned that incidentally affects speech and conduct that is targeted for its speech to be banned. And let me call the court's attention.
Mr. Enid, I know you're eager to get to that chart and maybe to answer a lot of the questions that we have, but I just want to ask you, now, how does this tax, if it is a tax, it's only $5, how does that affect the First Amendment and the right to express this, if it is an expression, as free speech?
Well, Your Honor,
I can see if maybe it was $100, but just $5.
Well, as a matter of fact, Your Honor, let's talk about the fee cases. We've cited the court to the fees cases. They've ignored them altogether. The fee cases really impact the issue of a restriction, pre-restriction on speech. If you have to pay a fee in order to make the speech, it's like a timing issue. There's a constitutional limit. The courts that talk about a fee for the privilege of making speech has to be reasonably related to the cost of policing the activity surrounding the speech and therefore has to be revenue neutral. The financial report on this statute was that it would tax 169 businesses and generate $87 million for the fund in Texas. That's over $500,000 a year per establishment. This is not a $5 head tax. It seems to be nominal.
It's not really costing the establishment. It's costing the patrons that visit there, right?
Well, the statute says you could charge the patrons or you could charge it from the establishment. But the fee cases are very careful to point out that we measure the fee against the cost of policing. There is no policing here. There is no showing here. They don't even make an argument that $87 million a year is what's necessary to police these establishments. And, in fact, there's no policing the establishments at all. So in answer to your question, it's not the issue of the $5. You can't tax content-based speech. You can have a fee or a permit, but it has to be revenue neutral. That's the answer to the question about a tax on content-based speech.
But to take you back just a moment to something you said earlier, you think the issue is with nude entertainment, that if the statute just said businesses that serve alcohol and have nude employees, that you wouldn't have any problem with that?
Your Honor, the only problem, you would have to go through the intermediate scrutiny test. You would have to go through the intermediate scrutiny test because it does incidentally affect speech. And so you do have to go through a First Amendment test.
Well, I thought I understood you to concede earlier that the state could regulate public nudity.
Yes, Your Honor. Under Barnes and Pabst, they could regulate public nudity if they satisfied the intermediate scrutiny test.
And would this do that?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because it's not narrowly tailored. There's no predominant purpose to address secondary effects.
Why does it have? There is a purpose. Why isn't it? Why do you think it's not predominant?
Predominant, Your Honor, going to my wonderful chart, these cases break down between two issues: the revenue power of the state and the police power of the state. If it's the revenue power being exercised and it's content-based, strict scrutiny applies.
Well, but an argument's been made that the revenue power in certain circumstances is a regulatory power.
Your Honor, the argument is only made because they tell you to ignore the difference between a tax, a fee, and a regulation. That's the state's argument. The foundation of their argument is to ignore whether it's a tax or a regulation or a fee. But one thing for certain in the United States Supreme Court, whether they disagree about its protected speech or not protected speech, they are almost universally in agreement that whether it's a tax or whether it's the exercise of police power does make a difference. Anthony Kennedy says, while the city can zone adult businesses, it can't accomplish the same purpose affecting the secondary effects by imposing a fee on the adult business. And Justice Scalia addresses the very argument that the state made here this morning, that if I'm speeding down the road and I get caught and I pay a fine, that's the same thing as paying a license fee to speed down the road. Justice Scalia is very pointed about that. It is a fundamental difference between prohibiting yelling fire in a crowded theater and charging a tax for the privilege. And the reason there's a difference is because the tax for the privilege disconnects, delinks this police power from the secondary effects it's affecting.
Well, in that situation, the fee doesn't advance the purpose. In fact, it undermines the purpose of the ban on crying fire in a crowded theater. In this situation, the argument is made that the fee, or the license, if you will, to be able to view nude expression and drink alcohol, it does have that secondary effect. It does reduce the number of people who frequent these establishments. So it is distinguishable from that case, isn't it?
I disagree, Your Honor, because that's a primary effect, not a secondary effect. Secondary effects are crime. It's the linking of alcohol and viewing live nude performances that leads to sexual assault. That's the secondary effect. If the police power is being exercised, you can move it. That's what Scalia was getting at in the fire analysis. If the state really believes that crime is caused by this connection, then the state is inconsistent by giving you permission to do exactly that, subject to paying a tax. It is an entirely different thing to have permission to do the thing that harms your community if you pay a tax, as opposed to the state saying, this is harm to the community. But we can step in and we can prohibit the conduct, we can slow the conduct down, we can change the manner of the
but
conduct.
But hasn't the court sort of created some leeway here to experiment in terms of reducing secondary effects in this area?
Your Honor, only if the predominant purpose in the statute is to address the secondary effects. If the predominant purpose in the statute has nothing to do with the secondary effects, White River out of the Second Circuit would say, wait a minute, you've never dropped out of strict scrutiny. Part of the issue that they raise in their briefs, they want the court to immediately jump to intermediate scrutiny, to assess whether you've got a predominant purpose. The predominant purpose has to be established through the statute first, before the court drops to whether they've satisfied intermediate scrutiny.
And the statute says the predominant purpose is to prevent sexual assault, and you argue the predominant purpose is to suppress erotic speech. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I don't think the statute says the predominant purpose is to address sexual assault. As a matter of fact, the predominant purpose is to raise a fee that will be deposited, $25 million.
I'll read it. An act relating to the imposition and use of a fee on certain sexually oriented businesses and certain programs for the prevention of sexual assault. But you don't read it. You don't read that sentence as expressing a purpose to prevent sexual assault.
All I see in the statute is to raise funds for a sexual assault funding program that could be resurrected from a general fund. If that were the case, then you dropped intermediate scrutiny, and it has to be narrowly tailored. And so the narrowly tailored is that it has to address the secondary effects.
What's this post-enactment evidence that your client complains of?
Your Honor, well, the post-enactment evidence was to come in and start arguing that there really was a connection, a linking between the conduct, the alcohol, and the live nude performance. Actually, the connection was between alcohol and sexual abuse, but the argument was, well, alcohol was consumed at these places so they could control it. That's post-enactment. But the confusion that's made is they want to use the post-enactment evidence to establish the predominant purpose of the statute. And the statute pays it into a fund. The statute does not address the secondary effects, which is to stop the conduct, which goes back to the point that they give permission to do the very thing that they claim causes the harm to the community.
So is there a way for the state to rewrite this statute so it complies and passes constitutional muster?
Your Honor, I do not think that the state could come and say the predominant purpose of this statute is to regulate the serving of alcohol at a live nude performance and use it to assess the tax. As a matter of fact, every case that has looked at zoning and regulation, every case that's looked at that has cautioned governments that what they can do through their police power by time, place, and manner restrictions, they cannot do through their general power to raise revenue.
Counsel,
which is to use a tax.
The state's response to that is all the tax cases you cite involve conduct that the state is not at liberty to ban, which is different from the conduct here. What's your answer to that?
Your Honor, I think that's a misreading of Barnes and Erie. Barnes and Erie is deciding, is live nude performance protected speech? And they say, just barely, if only marginally so. The Eighth Circuit reversed some of the words, attempting to quote Barnes, and said, came to the conclusion that live nude entertainment was barely protected as speech. The significance is that that's why in Alameda books, that's why in, I think it's in Flyfish, as a matter of fact, the 11th Circuit case, the courts are very careful to distinguish between the exercise of the police power, time, place, manner restrictions, and attacks on speech. Because of the very question that's been raised, they don't want a state to use its revenue power to raise funds off of speech.
Is it proper or not for the state to have the position that live nude dancing should be discouraged, either through a complete ban or zoning or a tax? Is it unconstitutional for the state to target live nude dancing because it believes it's culturally unsound, it's immoral, it's the kind of speech that should not occur and maybe ought to be banned or at least restricted? Is that not in conformity with the Constitution, in your view?
I think it would be very difficult for the state to say, as a predominant purpose, we don't approve of live nude dancing, and therefore we prohibit live nude dancing solely.
Okay, if it's not banned completely, can it be regulated? Can it be restricted to certain areas of the county, or can it be removed from churches and schools through zoning? And if that can be done, then why can't it be discouraged through a tax?
Your Honor, the first question, I do believe that if the predominant purpose of the statute was to address the secondary effects, of which there's evidence of secondary effects, and they applied a reasonable time, place, manner restriction, then the state could regulate to the extent of moving it someplace or the hours because they meet the intermediate scrutiny test on that. They cannot meet the intermediate scrutiny test because they cannot meet the predominant purpose test if it's a tax. Because if it's a tax, they've disconnected the predominant purpose to address secondary effects, the crime, by time, place, and manner restrictions, to a tax to generate revenue over the commission of the very thing they're claiming causes harmful effects. And it becomes a primary effect. I don't like the speech, therefore I tax the speech. That's what this is all trying to avoid.
Your concern about the record, I'm not clear on it. It's not so simple, I assume, that the legislature could just go back and make a fuller record. You don't think a record can be made, or that they just stubbed their toe?
Your Honor, to impose a tax like this, I don't think the record can be made, and I want to avoid the confusion.
Then what difference does it make if we look at post-enactment evidence? Because that if it doesn't legitimize a tax, it doesn't. If it does, you could just put it in the record.
Your Honor, is correct to ask the question. I have not been clear. Post-enactment evidence has nothing to do with whether this tax is permissible. But the entire breadth of the state's argument has been to ignore the tax cases. It doesn't apply based on a footnote, and to go immediately to intermediate scrutiny.
All right. The Court of Appeals expressed some concern about post-enactment evidence, and you don't share that concern. Or you do?
I do share the concern if you reach the question of post-enactment. I think Judge Jones went beyond where he needed to be because we were never in the intermediate scrutiny level anyway. But the enactment evidence, the evidence relied upon, has to appear someplace at the time they're doing the legislation.
Why? That's what I'm getting at. Why?
I think illusions helps explain. You can tell the intent of the legislature by the language it uses in the statute, but sometimes the language in the statute isn't sufficient, and so you look to the legislative history. But something has to appear at the time the statute is enacted to demonstrate the predominance. You can't take this statute, which is a fee imposed on the deal, and then come in years later and say, oh, but wait a minute, we have a different idea that is inconsistent with what the language of the statute is.
In the earlier case, it's important to know what the legislature was intending, what the Congress was intending, because the 14th Amendment does not let them set aside state immunity without clearly intending to do that. But here, aren't we more concerned with the effect of the statute, whatever the intent was of the legislature?
Your Honor, Simon & Schuster cautions courts not to divine the predominant purpose of the statute by the effect of the statute, because this predominant purpose has to be showing contemporaneously with the court coming in. The problem with Judge Puryear, who is one of the dissents, the dissent in this case, was he looked at, well, it did have a reduction, I'm not sure that's the case, in alcohol consumption. At least there was some testimony that somebody might drink one less beer if they had to pay $5. And he said that could be a purpose for the statute. But that's not intermediate scrutiny analysis.
I still don't understand if the legislature intended to address secondary effects and the post-enactment evidence showed that it just didn't happen, what difference would their intent make? It wouldn't save the statute.
Your Honor,
it looks to me like you can look at it for some things and not for others.
Your Honor, on whether you're trying to establish that you have a legitimate government concern, it doesn't matter if it, in fact, didn't address the government concern. In other words, post-enactment didn't have any effect on whether it was going to stop sexual assault or not. That is not sufficient to eliminate the government's substantial concern that they claim it to be. That's a different question than whether at the time the statute's enacted, you have evidence on the face of the statute, in the legislative history, that the purpose of the statute was not to to suppress a secondary effect. Otherwise, as the courts will say, facially content-based statute is presumptively unconstitutional. The way it survives is you have a predominant purpose to the statute that addresses a secondary effect, not the speech, and you do an intermediate scrutiny effect to determine whether it's addressing the secondary concerns. When you get to that point, it is irrelevant whether it in fact ameliorated the concerns. So the post-enactment is not the issue.
Counsel, to get into the First Amendment arena, there must be some expression or communication that is taxed or regulated, as the case may be. We haven't asked, what is the expression or communication here?
None of the expression is the dancing. Dancing is expressive. The act of dancing is expressive. And the threshold is not necessarily addressing speech. The threshold is whether speech is affected. If speech is affected and it's taxed, then it's strict scrutiny. If speech is affected, but only incidentally, then you can have intermediate scrutiny review and say, yes, to a certain extent, we permit speech to be imposed on because there are other effects of that speech that the police power entitles us to regulate.
What is being expressed? I don't mean to be flip, but you say the dance scene is the expressive activity, but what is the message conveyed? What is being expressed?
Eroticism. It's seeking to create emotion. It's seeking to create reaction. Not unlike Angels in America.
But that's not what's banned here. I mean, this regulation doesn't ban expression.
Your Honor, it expressly taxes live nude performances.
Nude expression. But it doesn't ban dancing or any sort of expressive dancing. It really is just more a ban on nudity combined with the expressive dancing, which is why the Supreme Court cases have afforded it minimal First Amendment protection. It's not an outright ban on expression.
Your Honor, if I may, reading those cases, in no case has a court banned live nude dancing. In every case, they've looked to see if nudity itself, beyond dancing, was either taxed or regulated. And because nudity beyond dancing was tax regulated, it was content neutral, not content based.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Enoch.
Mr. Ho, looking at opposing counsel's First Amendment flow chart, do you quibble with the chart itself? I know you quibble with where this case ought to reside on the flow chart, but is the flow chart itself accurate in your view?
I think the chart, frankly, proves our point, and let me explain why. The cases in the lower right-hand corner, Barnes, Pabst, Alameda Books, 44 Liquor Mart, all the cases at 44 Liquor Mart, endorses LaRue, Renton, all support, that's our whole case. That's why we win. White River is really sort of the bullet that they put in there. White River is a lower court case. We've never contested that different judges have different philosophies in this area. White River takes one view. Some Supreme Court justices, Brennan and others, take a different view. White River conflicts with Fantasy Ranch, the Fifth Circuit case. Granted, it's a Fifth Circuit case, not binding on this court, although it's written by members, former members of this court. Fantasy Ranch is also directly addresses all of these issues, goes exactly the opposite of what they're saying.
If this is, in fact, a police power, can you address Mr. Enoch's arguments regarding the predominant purpose and at the time of the enactment? We obviously didn't have some post-enactment evidence, but can you address that?
I would love to. They said that we ignored other purposes. I think, actually, I was embracing all the other purposes. The test is not predominant purpose. The test is one purpose. As long as we have one valid purpose, and that one valid purpose can be found anywhere, including in legal briefs,
but at the time of enactment,
we're fine.
At the time of
no. In Barnes and in Alameda Books, the court looked at legal briefs and just legal briefs. In Alameda Books, let me give you the page sites. Alameda Books at 436, Justice O'Connor looks at legal briefs. In Section 3 of Kennedy's concurrence, he's looking at either legal briefs or, frankly, I think he's identifying his own interests that nobody identified and using that to uphold the statute. And, of course, Justice Souter in Barnes looks at legal briefs at page 582.
What is the strongest argument of what we should look at here? For
the best evidence of our government interest, it's in the statutory text because they're limiting just to the nude dancing and the alcohol, consistent with 40 years of precedent, and our briefs. We're asserting our government interests right here and now, just as Souter allowed.
As it relates to this being the predominant purpose, just to suppress the secondary effects of the sexual assault.
Right. It is, like I said, that is the evidence of the purpose, and it's not predominant purpose. They keep saying that. Renton says that a predominant purpose is more than adequate. We just need one purpose. That's Pabst AM.
Now, this is sort of an exaggeration of your opponent's argument, but he's saying, in effect, the state is a hypocrite, that the state is exploiting the source of the secondary effect itself. It's making money off of a business that has this sexual assault component to it. And is that really a tax or a regulation? And if it's a tax, it's more of a tax on the expression itself. The state doesn't like that expression, and so it's trying to get rid of it, and strict scrutiny would apply.
There are a lot of taxes that have multiple purposes. And so if the court wants to conclude that we have multiple purposes here, that's certainly a reasonable conclusion, and we would win under that conclusion, because all we need is one purpose, and that one purpose could be found anywhere. The majority.
Yes, but the point is the goal is to minimize the secondary effect, right? And you're using money through the live music combined with alcohol in order to minimize that impact. And what I understand part of the argument over there to be is this is really a tax on the expression, and it's in being used in sort of a hypocritical way because it is profiting off of the very thing that it condemns.
I see your point, Your Honor. My answer is this. Could we have imposed a stricter requirement, make it a crime? Sure. That the exact same analysis was addressed and rejected in Pabst AM. In Pabst AM, as Justice O'Neill noted, and Barnes, one last stitch. You know, that's pretty minimal requirement. A lot of the justices objected that that doesn't really do very much. It doesn't affect your interests at all. Frankly, you'd be better off imposing more clothing requirements. The court nevertheless upheld it because we're talking about giving states reasonable opportunity to regulate. And that's exactly what's going on here. Could we have made it a crime? Sure, we could have made it a felony, I suppose. But we don't have to. This is a quintessential legislative judgment, and the U.S. Supreme Court has specifically said, in this area in particular, give reasonable opportunity to experiment. The majority below rejected most of the plaintiff's arguments. The U.S. Supreme Court has frankly rejected them all. I see that my time is up. If there are no further questions.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning. Once again, on behalf of the court, we would like to thank St. Mary's University, the dean, its faculty, all the assistant deans, and the students for your rapt attention in all three cases this morning. We are going to be having a luncheon shortly, and I believe that students are invited to that, and a question and answer period in the library. So we will see you then, and we'll be back in just a moment for some photographs. But all causes have been submitted, and the marshal will now formally adjourn the court.
All rise. Okay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.